I have to tell you this story, though. I've been riding this guy for, I don't know, about 10 years or so now. I don't even know how we first got introduced. He's a great publisher. He's a great editor. He's written a lot of great books of his own. He's done some audio CDs, many, many audio CDs. He's got a great literary website, and I believe he's done hundreds, literally hundreds of readings in Southern California.
That's not that many.
Well, not many, but a lot. And you've done some...
Ten.
And you've done a few up in around Sacramento, right? But I am correct in suggesting that you are a Berkeley poetry virgin. Is this your first reading?
Yeah, true.
We've got a Berkeley poetry virgin. And so that is why I have chosen to climax the evening. All right. Well, I love this guy. I don't, you know. With Robert Rode, and he drove all the way down from Sacramento to be with us tonight, and we worked together too.
Eric, I'd like to try to do one with you at the end and see if it works out.
Actually, David forgot to give us your name.
Robert Rode.
Oh, he said. Okay. It's in one of these poems I'm going to read, too. So
worked it in.
Yeah, worked it in. Every poet needs to do that at least once. This one's called Obvious Koan. A student came to the master armed only with this. There are many different types of students, but the most common type of student is the average student. To which the master replied, "Take my seat."
Here, here.
It's a common response in a lot of Chinese Zen koans. Take my seat. Okay. This is the plight of an average Menelaus. According to Julia Turner's account of Troy, casting directors had difficult work finding an actress beautiful enough to be Helen worthy. For no woman seems to have the power in our age to have 1,000 ships launched after her. Evidently, in their search for this perfect starlet, agents appraised beauty in Mila Helens. I cannot help but try to figure out how many Mila Helens my own wife would rate, dispatching the thought that I haven't any ships should she be stolen from me by another. I ponder this, but soon I am on to past lovers, trying to gauge their value on this grand scale. Since I never owned a boat but wrote ardently undulating letters to some of them, I try to remember how many missives I launched after they were gone for more enticing shores or stronger arms. There was L.W., definitely several Mila Helens, or a dozen, though I'm willing to admit that that figure may have had more to do with my psychosis than her beauty. And J.R., whose lips alone would call forth 10, another 29 for her green eyes. Green eyes always sail ships. After running through the rest of this small roster, I start computing the allure of lovers I wish I had. They're C.S., for whom if I had 119 cruisers, I would surely send them out to sea. And I think of AF, easily 100 boats, if not more, I'd send afloat. I cannot think of one for whom I would start a war, but several cross my mind as worthy of bruises and a black eye or two. I never really decide about my wife. If she were taken, it would be my own fault, no doubt, as much as an effect of her beauty. I know that when a woman leaves, it's far too late to send the vessels you should have all along. So instead of calculating crafts, I measure her grace in glances, those looks I give her from across the room, where she looks back and whispers, "What?" as if she doesn't know what I'm thinking when I stare at her like that for the 900th time.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not going to take up too much of your time. I couldn't make the earlier reading because I was working, but I wanted to read a couple poems that were about witness, hopefully, as well. Near the bottom. My wife comes home with several boxes of food from a local charity. We're apparently entitled to 8 at this point, with 4 children and our modest beginnings at work. The opportunities to feel poor have been plentiful lately, though I try to tell my daughters that our station is only temporary. My youngest is embarrassed until she finds a box of Trix cereal in each of the large cartons, along with several fruit bars we would normally buy in the store. I cannot get over the different cans of tuna. One looks like something left over from 50s fallout shelters. The other, Sunny Select, suspiciously resembles cat food. The label on the green can of possibly radioactive tuna reads, "Donated by the people of the United States of America for domestic food assistance programs," and offers such basic instructions as, "Refrigerate after opening. Use within 24 hours. The other can advertises that it's dolphin safe, a product of Thailand. It does not state how long it will last. Though I feel somewhat diminished digging through these cans of unheard of brands with pictures reminiscent of 70s Technicolor, I feel a slight chill when I discover, near the bottom, a 6-pack of soda bearing the name Open Cola. The cans are somewhat modern and read, "Check out the source at opencola.com." Beneath that I see version 1.0 and open can excitedly, join can and mouth while cola is remaining greater than zero, if really thirsty, chug, else sip. The cola is another product of the United States, and I cannot help but think that so is everything else about the way that I'm looking at this. It is difficult to know how to feel about the packaging ploy going on here, with all the dollar signs, parentheses, and so forth scattered in the text on the can. It becomes clear to me that I must solve this strange equation. I listen intently as I pull back the tab and hear the bubbles whispering as they pop.
Yes. Yes.
This one's called Resignation. In April, birds nest above our ceiling. They make their way through ventilation ducts. Then we hear them mating in the crawl space. In late July, one dies from heat. I find several feathers when I pull aside a light fixture in the kitchen ceiling, where maggots have been slowly dropping all this morning into the stainless basin of the steel sink. I breathe the stink of something rotting, something forgotten. I should have called the landlord sooner, but I thought, no harm in letting birds have shelter. In November, I recall a blackbird rested on our banister, stayed the night Thanksgiving, puddling dung along the balcony. I shone a light on him, then doused him with a rail of water, but he hung on like a curse, so I went about my business. I begin to sense these birds have brought dark omens, so I take to the sofa to relax my tightening stomach. But on the way, I find that ants have taken over the whole living room, crawling on the carpet, not in trails, but in some dark, complex array of chaos, as if what they've been searching for, the sweetness, has disappeared. Straying. We lament the walk, the way we used to amble with purpose, wander in our wandering. Our youth has gone the way of the walk, trodden out thinly. We dream of the one time we left the house to walk in the rain, our only aim, the fresh kiss, a torrent upon forgotten lips. We used to walk the dog of our desire on a thin leash, untethering it behind the bushes. Now we only hear the howls of far-off canines and grind our teeth in sleep. Our ambulatory insights have dulled with our incisors. Our bark has replaced our bite. We fool ourselves with the notion of growth, which is only skin thickening. I don't know what you'll make of this one. I think it was I remember turning this into a poetry class, and the teacher was like, "What's the point?" You know, he's like, and I wanted it to be in maybe a painting like this one, but he just wouldn't have it. So I don't know what to make of it. It's called The Entrepreneur and the Fence. Along the nearby riverbed runs a fence and a golf course. On one side of the wire mesh is a bike trail, where a man stands with one hand on the fence, his spare hand holding a brown paper sack. On the other side, another man leans out of his golf cart, turning over a Ziploc bag containing six shiny white golf balls. He seems to be checking the weight in his palm as he raises and lowers his arm, asking, "How much?" Thought I'd try it, didn't know.
I don't know whether that worked or not. Maybe it's a depth charge that'll come out.
Maybe. Television takes two hostage. This is sort of a found poem from the Orange County Register when I lived in Southern California. "I'm mad as heck, and so are a lot of other people," said Marie Lumiere, a Huntington Beach resident who blamed time. "Deborah Dillon of Fountain Valley blamed Disney, and they've taken me hostage for 2 days," she said. Lumiere, who blamed Time Warner, said, "The integrity of Time Warner is very much at stake here. The fact that they interrupted viewing for even 5 minutes, let alone an hour or even a day, was way, way out of line." One viewer, Robert Roden of Orange, blamed God, expressing his dissension by vehemently decrying all conglomerates. "It's only television, for Christ's sakes," Roden said, but we found his opinion unfit to print. And then I've got a couple poems here. I've got just a few more. A couple that are similar. I guess it's sort of the Lynn Lifshin mode of like writing 20 poems on the same topic if you can. And so maybe these are identical. I don't know. I'll try this. This is the newest one. It's called Witnessing. "You've all seen, I suppose, the religious writings of those in bathroom stalls who praise the Lord. I'm reminded of Perry Farrell, who once said of his song Pigs and Zen that flowers grow best in shit. I can relate to that sentiment, but I'm not sure that that's what God had in mind when he is said to have said, 'Go forth and spread the word.'" Maybe I should leave it there. "What do I know of God's intentions truly? Still, I don't think he'd find this kind of propagation of his vision quite the type he had in mind. I'm not just talking about the ones who leave occasional tracks behind. My favorite, 'From Heroin Death to Healing Life,' about a drug addict who reforms and finds the Lord more heavenly than heroin. But those who vandalize in the name of one so great. I know the irony of those who drive Mercedes-Benzes with license plate frames claiming that Jesus rides with them, and that property means nothing to the true Christian, but I'm still puzzled by those engaged in acts of defacing bathroom walls for a chance at glory, his or theirs." Recovering over a cold, so very dried out here. Lots of water has been helpful. "Works in mysterious ways. Someone has written in pencil, 'Have you found Jesus?' on the toilet paper dispenser in the men's room at college. I know that people discover the Lord at unexpected times." "But I wonder who would find him here. Perhaps it's a man in the midst of constipated prayer. 'I swear, God, that if you help me through this, I'll eat more vegetables and be kinder to my family.' I see him pulling the white paper, hoping his sins will be absolved, wiped away. Do you know where this is going? It was, if you, this might not have come up if the toilet poem hadn't been recited. "The one who finds God here must be like the one who stands at the urinal with his belt around his arm, his syringe primed and ready, until he sees the swisher splash guard admonishing, 'Say no to drugs,' and drops the needle to the tile." I have to explain it maybe for the ladies in the room. When the men walk into the restroom, they have, you know, the urinals there. not the Duchamp style, but the regular style. And I know for years there have been these like little splash guards or something, and they say no to drugs, and they put them inside these urinals. I have no idea who they're hoping to reach. And, okay, maybe he's the one.
Maybe
that's a good idea.
It's supposed to imply that you might get tested for drugs.
Maybe. Oh. Maybe he's the one who, having just put the ecstasy in his mouth, spits it out into the toilet. From the other writings here, we can already see that the bathroom stall is the modern-day confessional, the blogosphere of the computerless class, the janitor, the server, the new high priest. Okay, one more and then I'll get your help. Okay. In my flight from Sacramento to Orange County, moving through airport security checkpoints, I am routinely stopped, even after dropping my shoes, belt, watch, wallet, change, keys, and pens into the institutional gray collection tray. With my pants hanging half off my ass, at last I'm in style, I pass through the clanging gate, wondering if Cerberus or St. Peter will greet me. But instead I get, mail assist on one. It's the aluminum bracelet I found in the street one night, bouncing across the asphalt as I stood alarmed at the sound of dancing metal, light in the air, that gets me noticed. I always feel like the arrested pedestrian in Bradbury's tale, guilty of walking late at night and finding treasure in the avenue. I refuse to remove the band from my wrist, so the hulking TSA man looms to scan me. Lots of Indian guys wear those, he says, raising the black bar. But that's their religion. You just wear it because you're pimping, ain't you? He nods, grazing the rivets of my sagging jeans as his magic wand emits two short beeps. That's right, I say, glad to be recognized as the prodigal OG returning to OC. Ascending with that ringing in my ears. Maybe with the, one of your silencers.
What kind of
it's a kind of long, it's a lament. It's like that.
Yeah. Do you want some background?
Yeah, I'm not too practiced at the call and response sort of thing. I might try it, but yeah. Right. And I'll put it here too, so you can look at it. So go ahead and start. This is lament number one. Elliot, today is my daughter's birthday, and my son's is just 2 days away. 48 hours ago, you were found on a kitchen floor in the afternoon with an apparently self-inflicted knife wound in your chest. News of your death does not make the front page, which seems fitting. But I have been reading nearly every notice I can get my eyes on since yesterday when the first note arrived. Most of the accounts read exactly the same. Your real name, Stephen Paul. Your age, the same as mine. Some past quote about your battle with the bottle, or a line about the needle in the hay. Many mention your final single released on Seattle's Suicide Squeeze. Some reports claim a nameless woman found you. Others say she was your live-in girlfriend who took you to the hospital, where they pronounced you dead an hour later. But these announcements don't describe the blood that must have been everywhere, oiling the linoleum. They don't tell how that angel had to walk across the sticky puddle of your heart. But I can see it clearly, Elliot. I can't stop thinking about your heart and its bittersweet songs pumping out. Your records are scattered all over my living room floor. And coming through the door yesterday, my wife found me watching your strange parallel. I am haunted by the image. How you poured dirt from the mouth of your buried guitar, recently unearthed, with a sharp spade, amidst an audience of trees. I know this is merely a trick with cameras, frozen and sliced frames, but as you began strumming the chords of that cutting waltz number 2, I doubted you were really dead, though I know Silver Lake isn't quite Hollywood. The first time I saw you play at the Troubadour, it was only you and your guitar that night, an intimacy we'd miss, a nakedness in your later shows with the band. Another time you played the Roxy, where my future wife rested 8 months pregnant beside me. Courtney Love sat across from Michael Stipe at the table just behind us. She kept yelling at the waitress over drinks during your songs. You think she'd know better, that one day you would be as silent as her husband. Elliot, Elliot, God damn you, Elliot, I'm starting to cry. I keep trying to follow you down to the Rose Parade in my search. I know I did not know you, for you hardly spoke, but through your songs. They were whispers, though. Each one made us gasp, as if we were taking our last breaths. I remember one night walking off some anger in the streets of Bothell, Washington, your sickle cell hanging over my shoulder, and your songs stinging in my ears. Another time I wrote your mantra, "Everything means nothing to me," 100 times in a tattered notebook, until a fragile strand of hope returned. I have to get that back, for it's thin as the first E string. Today is my daughter's birthday. She wants a new guitar and a strap with moons and stars. And I have got to celebrate, celebrate before your absence kills me. I'm never gonna know you now, but I'm gonna love you anyhow.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.